Oh, and I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, okay. Don't we? Hi, I'm Claire Hall, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, gosh. Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Joey. Thank you, everybody who made it possible for me to come back down. And thank you for the amazing food, the absolutely amazing food. I was telling Lee, this has been a really kind of stressful couple years for me because I've been sick for the last 2 years. And it's not anything that was going to kill me. It was just going to completely change my life. And one of the consequences of that is that I've lost my sense of taste and smell. So it's like, oh, it's an amazing thing, and I'll just do this. And I picked up somebody's no-name chips that put out just no-name chips, and I could taste them. And it was everything I could do not to hoard them and take them home with me. I have no idea what they were, but they were wonderful for somebody who doesn't taste anymore. So, and if you brought the no-name chips, I want to know what they were. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I have developed a love and a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. It has changed my world. It has changed my world. I'm going to start with a couple of basics that just kind of qualify me to be standing up in front of you. And that first thing is that I have a sobriety date. I have a sobriety date that means the world to me and that I cherish and protect with everything I have. And my sobriety date is September 3rd, 1977. So that means last September I celebrated 38 years of continuous sobriety. So, and I got to tell you, when somebody asks me, well, how many 24 hours do you have? It's really cool to slip in that I've got 38 years. But, you know, I have 38 years of continuous sobriety. And I have 17 years of recovery. For me, there are very different statements. I stopped drinking in 1977. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, at that point in time, there was a lot of talk of put the plug in the jug and go to lots of meetings. Don't drink in between meetings, just don't drink and go to meetings. Don't drink, go to meetings, everything will be fine. Everything is not fine, guys. But that's what I heard and that's what I thought. I thought I had joined a fellowship of people who just didn't drink. I didn't hear about a program of recovery. I didn't know that this was a program to save me from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. You know, I joined the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think in the beginning that was important because I suffer from the horrible loneliness that the book talks about. I would hope by my calling out what my sobriety date was and telling you how many years, you already understand that I got sober super young, just really, really young. But even getting introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous before I hit 20, I didn't know how to mix. I was living in isolation. I was so different from my fellows. You know, I was, I don't know how to mix. I suffer from the ism of alcoholism before I took my first drink. I was selfish. I was self-absorbed. I was self-centered. I was nervous. I was all kinds of things before I ever took a drink. I don't have a really low bottom. Yay me. But once I found what alcohol could do for me, I got it as frequently as I could. And because I'm not a very bright alcoholic, and I'm a young alcoholic, I was a periodic alcoholic. You know, I didn't have access to alcohol all the time. But when I wasn't drinking it, I was trying to figure out how to get it. So I had the mental obsession and the physical allergy from the get-go. I do not believe that I did not cross any line into alcoholism. If there was a line to cross, I passed it in the birth canal on my way out. I came out an alcoholic. I just hadn't found alcohol yet. But I had all the signs and symptoms, the irritability, the restlessness, the inability to get along with my fellows, self, you know, absorption, and terminally unique. Terminally unique. So, so that was an interesting statement. So, when I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got introduced by a woman who had never seen me drink. But she had identified that mental obsession in me. She heard me talking and planning and scoping and when can I and how can I, and then if I was able to get alcohol, then it was reliving it, and wasn't it great, and we did this and we did that, and you know, everything, the complete obsession with alcohol, drinking or not drinking. And she took me to a meeting. I was living in the San Fernando Valley at that time. And I knew that she was a recovering alcoholic. She had shared that with me. We met at another event. And she said she was going to a meeting, and did I want to go with her? And I thought, well, that would be the kind things to do, would be to go and support her. And so I went to support her, and we went to the Hole in the Sky, which I now know is in Canoga Park. I thought it was in Reseda, but it was, yeah, we went to the Hole in the Sky. And she said, don't say anything. Just sit down and listen, and we'll talk about it afterwards. Okay. So I went up the stairs into the meeting, and a couple of things became very apparent. One, it was filled with old people. Old people. They were in their 30s and 40s, and oh my God. And, you know, and I'm sitting there just thinking, oh, this'll end, you know. I mean, they don't last forever. But and then people started sharing, and they started sharing about losing things. They lost jobs. They had lost their children. They had lost their partners. They had lost their homes. They had lost their cars. And all I heard was loser. There was no connection with how that had come to be. I just thought, losers. And I'm looking at my friend who I just adore, thinking, why do you hang out here? What, isn't there another class of people we could be socializing with? Isn't there a better form of alcoholics somewhere? And at the end of the meeting, she asked if I had identified. No, I did not. She said, well, Claire, let's just cut to the chase. If I told you could never have another drink, would you have a problem with that? I said, yes. Wait a minute. Wait. I'm going to have champagne at my wedding. And she said, stop me if I'm wrong. You're not dating anyone. I said, yeah, but, you know, I will. And she said, that's alcoholic thinking. And what I heard was, womp, 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 alcohol. I did not understand what she was saying. To not stop doing something harmful today for some unknown date in the future when you might need it. And she said, you know, Claire, if you don't drink, you'll be welcomed to all these meetings. And she had gotten a directory of the San Fernando Valley. And there were hundreds of meetings. She said, all you have to do is not drink, and you can go to everyone, any of these meetings, and be welcomed. Well, I hadn't had anywhere to go for quite a while. And I'm a periodic, so it doesn't sound like a big requirement for me. Sure, I can stop drinking. And I set about to do that. And I hit meetings and hit meetings and hit meetings and do it. And I can tell you today exactly how long I can go without a drink, or without a program of recovery, or without intensive therapy. And I can go 10 months. 10 months. Now, when I started going to those meetings, I was young. And I got a lot of, you're too young to be here. And I spilt more than you drank, which let me know that you really sloppy drunk. When you don't get alcohol very often, you're very careful. You do not spill drinks. and that I didn't have the right motives for being there. And they were well-meaning people. I'm sure I was annoying, and I'm sure they were waiting for me to drink. But I took that information, and I put it in the back of my mind. And if you're sitting in this room, and you're not quite sure, but you're hanging out here, and somebody says, maybe you're not, or you haven't fulfilled the requirements, or you don't have the right motives yet, I want you to know that we have a tradition that says all those who wish to recover from alcoholism are welcome. All those who suffer from alcoholism are welcome. I didn't hear that. And I didn't know that I had earned my seat, you know, that I could stay. But I heard that I wasn't one of you. And at 10 months, I am irritable, restless, and discontent. To kind of sum it up, your breathing is bothering me. You're super annoying. And what piece of information floats to my mind? The real alcoholics in the room said I wasn't one of them, that I was too young. And I truly believe that it would be a crime to have stopped drinking if I am not an alcoholic. I mean, that would be a travesty. So, and kind of if you're agreeing with me and you're in the room, we're kind of the only people who think that. People who don't have a problem with drinking don't think it would be a travesty not to be able to drink again. But I thought I should test that. I have never had one drink. Never. I mean, really, what's the point? It's not like I'm going for the taste. I'm not even legal to drink. You know, I don't know about good tasting liquor. I know about what I find in the bottom of your cupboard. You know, when I'm babysitting your kids or when I'm, you know, I drink garbage and I drink volume. I am a volume drinker. And so I thought, well, if I could have one drink, then I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And I got a date, and we went down to Beach Bumbert's in the harbor. And I thought, okay, I have to do things differently right from the beginning, right from the start. So we ordered drinks. Wait staff went away, came back. I let him put it on the table. I didn't intercept it when it came into my sphere. He got to put the glass on the table. And I let it sit there for a couple minutes. And then I picked it up, and I took a sip. I'm not a sipper. Again, I'm a volume drinker. My husband is a friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is not a member. And he has always told me that he's very grateful that he didn't know me when I was drinking, because he's watched me drink coffee, and it scares him. Oh, I took a sip, and I put it down. And then I start looking around the room, and I want to see how frequently do you pick up a drink. And I start to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is 10 enough? I pick it up. I take a sip. I put it down. Take my finger off of it. You know, I'm nodding appreciatively. I'm watching ice dilute my glass, you know, my liquor. I've never had a diluted drink. Is it going to ruin the drink? I don't know what it's going to taste like. He's talking. I'm counting, sipping, drinking, counting, sipping, putting down. And I finally finished that date with one drink. And I walked out of that restaurant thinking, thank God, I am not an alcoholic. And I went drinking, you know, because I had opened the door. I had triggered that phenomenon of craving, and I needed more. I needed more. And that started me on a four-month run, small in some comparison, but it was enough for me. Because where I had been a periodic, I'd just come off a 10-month not drinking thing. And now I'm drinking every Friday night, every Friday, Saturday night, every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I'm starting on Thursday sometimes. And the only reason I didn't become a daily drinker is because of you. Because when I was attending the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was sitting in those meetings, I was listening. Not necessarily identifying, but I was listening. And you talked about the progression of the disease. You talked about that when I started drinking, I would not go back to where I was. I would move forward. And that I would not be satisfied with the way it used to be. It would be a new marker. And I would need more. And I was seeing that. I drink and drive, which means that I have no regard whatsoever about the quality or the welfare of your life. I'm willing to kill you as part of my entertainment. Because, see, I just don't drink and drive to get to and from the party. It's part of the night. When it gets to the point where I have had that psychic change, and yippee for me, I now think I'm Mario Andretti. And I jump in my car and I race around my little beach community where I was born and raised. And the fact that I didn't kill anybody or run into anything is just my story. I don't think, well, I would have told you then I'm a really good driver. But it just didn't happen. And it was in the, you know, the mid to late 70s, and we didn't have MAD. We didn't have the alcohol awareness education that we have now. Nobody knew what I was doing. It was just youthful indiscretion drinking. And I'm a maniac. And I show up at work intoxicated. I work at a hospital, and I show up after shift seeing who's ready to get off and party. You know, and the staff is trying to hustle me out of the emergency room before I wake the doctor, which would basically mean my job. You know, I would be walked out of that job if I woke the doctor. That goes on for about 4 months, and I'm noticing it. And I showed up at a party where my family was. It was my brother-in-law's birthday party. They set the bar up in the kitchen. I didn't see any reason to leave the kitchen. My family came looking for me. I do not come from an alcoholic family. I'm it. I am the alcoholic. You know, I used to say I didn't come from a dysfunctional family. I was the dysfunction, you know. It was me, the difficult kid. And I'm just sitting there drinking margaritas, and they asked me what I was doing, and I said, I'm having a drink. And they said, yeah, but those are tumblers. We have the stemware, right? Why are you drinking from a 16, 20-ounce glass? And I'm like, how I drink. And they looked at me with disgust. And I hadn't been hanging out with anybody who looked at me with disgust when I drank, because we find our own level. I want to blend in. I do not want to stand out. I want to blend in. So you have to keep finding a lower level of companionship. And so to have somebody look me in the eye and go, that's not the way we drink. You know, the best I could do is figure out that I had chosen the wrong place to party. And I picked up my keys, bid happy birthday to the boy, and took off. And the next morning I woke up, and there was a different atmosphere in my household. My mother was not happy. My other family members were really looking at me funny. And I made a phone call. You know, I made a phone call. And I called a guy who I had met in the program. That's kind of a theme. You might want to pick up on that. But I called a guy and I said, I need you to take me out Friday night. If you don't take me out, I will be drunk. And he said, I'll meet you in Los Angeles. And we arranged to meet at a restaurant, and I drove to that event thinking, you know, he's going to tell me the same thing. I'm too young. You know, this is youthful indiscretion. Every young person experiences and experiments, and you'll grow out of it. I really expected him to come across with that. But what he said was, Claire, I can't tell you whether you're an alcoholic or not, but if alcohol is interfering with your ability to show up and be present in your life, then you know what to do and you know where to go. And I didn't think he was being very nice. But we finished that. He bid me farewell. I got into my car. I am the only person in my car. but the committee joins me. And the topic of discussion for the night is whether or not I am an alcoholic. And it's a loud, you ever get to one of those meetings where it's a hot topic and everybody wants to chip in and give their, well, this was a hot topic meeting, let me tell you. And there was a lot of cross debate and cross talk, and finally they were screaming at each other across the room, and that it's no big deal, my drinking is no big deal. I just turned 21. It's my right to drink. And it's a big deal, I could leave it any time. Any time I can stop and go the other direction. And this little voice said, well, great, if it's no big deal, then just never pick up another drink and it'll be no big deal. And I had my first of many moments of clarity, and I knew I could no more not pick up another drink than I could park the car and fly home. I thought, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic and my life is over. And I went back, you know, absolutely dejected. I went back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, please understand that what I am sharing with you is my experience. I do not have any opinions on fellowships or Alano clubs or meetings or groups. Or, you know, this is simply my experience. But the only thing I knew about was fellowships and Alano clubs. And so that's where I went. And unfortunately, I did not choose wisely, because when I tell you I was welcomed warmly by that Alano club, that would be an understatement. 13-step bait lit up over my head like a neon flashing light, and I was flocked to and welcomed. It took me a lot of years to figure out that I was not the only woman in Los Angeles getting sober in 1977. But I don't remember seeing any women at the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew there were lots of men and that I was very popular. But no one came up and welcomed me of the female persuasion. And I have talked to other people who have gotten sober young and gotten sober back in those 70s, you know, early 80s, and they have said the same thing. We were a threat. You know, that their experience was that the women did not greet them. Men did, the women did not. And that was really my story. Now, I should tell you a little bit about how I showed up at that meeting and subsequent meetings. Just take you back to 1977. What was popular to wear in 1977 were denim jean jumpsuits. Sometimes haltered, sometimes not, but they only had one way into them. It was a big brass zipper that usually went from cleavage to crotch. And I would, and platform shoes, oh my gosh, big platform shoes. Elton John was all the rage. And I would show up into Alcoholics Anonymous. I would come in just before the meeting started, okay? And I like to sit up here because I like to show my willingness, okay? So I sit right up here. But you know what? The coffee machine's over there. So I drop my bag and I clomp, 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 clomp over to the coffee pot. Oh, they only have 6 and 8 ounce cups. So I get a cup of coffee and I clomp, 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 clomp back. I'm a fast drinker. Whew, that goes. Now the meeting has started, but I need another cup of coffee. So I clomp, 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 clomp. Get another cup. Clomp, 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 clomp. I am oblivious that I am interrupting the meeting. And I plop back down and I drink that cup of coffee. And now I'm bored, because these meetings are so long and they talk so much. And I can hardly wait to get back in the parking lot where the real action is. So I sit in the meeting and I play with my zipper. And I wonder why I'm so popular. (Clears throat) And again, nobody has explained to me that this is Alcoholics Anonymous and a program to save your life. I have joined the fellowship. The fellowship is happening out in the parking lot. The fellowship is happening at the dances. And I want to get back to the action. The problem was is that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to find a solution to my drinking. And I had stopped drinking and joined the fellowship. But what I didn't come here to do was to be passed around like a party favor, and that's what was happening. I was just going from guy to guy to guy to guy to guy. And one day I got tired of that, and I said no. But see, that guy had seen me give it away to every other person. Well, not every other person, but several. Several of the other gentlemen in the house, and he wanted his. And so I was raped. And I share that because it is my story. But it carries a message that I'd like to tell. Because sometimes we forget why we show up at meetings. Sometimes we think we're here to meet our buddies and pals. Sometimes we think we're here just for fellowship and the camaraderie, and that's all important. But the reason we show up at meetings is to identify the still suffering alcoholic, to find the newcomer and introduce them to a way of life that is beyond them. And I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous off a drinking run where I knew to be welcomed, I needed to sell a piece of myself. There isn't a woman here that doesn't know when you run out of money at a bar, there is another readily available commodity to get you your next drink. And I knew that, and I wanted to stay. I liked it here. So when they said that was the price of admission, no woman intercepted that idea and said no. Nobody said to me, Claire, get off his lap, pull your tongue out from the back of his throat, and come into the meeting and sit by me. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You no longer have to sell yourself to belong. But nobody did that. So I share my story so that when you go to a meeting, you will be looking for that newcomer. That newcomer that's coming in, sometimes inappropriately dressed, but they're dressing like they did when they partied. They don't know. They're going here and they want to be accepted. They always dressed up before to go partying. Now they're going to dress up here. You know, I had to learn that wearing clothes was really an appropriate thing to do at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, to cover it up a bit, Claire. But I didn't know. And so when somebody stands up and has the courage to identify them as new themselves, go get them. Save them a seat next to you. Those newcomers often sit in the back because we've put our keys and our cones and our phones and we've locked up the front seats. Save a seat for a newcomer. Welcome them into the fold. You don't know which life you're saving, whether it will be your life or theirs. Predators and Alcoholics Anonymous come in both sexes. I sponsored a woman who loved newcomer men. Oh my God, get them young, train them right. And I would tell her she had to stop that. Stop it. You know, and she said, oh, I just love newcomers. I said, yeah, but see, you know, they don't know that you're not serious. They're coming out here not after a good run. Nobody comes in here on a winning streak. You romance them. They think they've found it. And you're just waiting for the next bright, shiny object to come through the room. I said, you're killing them. If you want to work with me, you will stop it. And she did. But we really need to take care of our newcomers, and we have to give them an opportunity to learn what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it isn't. Wasn't my experience? I had to leave the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not safe to be here. And I went into therapy. And I did some really wonderful work in therapy. I do not put therapy down. But therapy was not treating my alcoholism. And I stayed in therapy for a long time. Oh, I mean, maybe some people wouldn't think it was a long time. It was only 20 years. But the problem with therapy in me was that my therapist thought that everything that had happened to me up to that point in my life had been tragic. And that I, you know, and that my mother didn't, you know, my mother wasn't the kind and loving person that I deserved. So I never needed to forgive her for the errors of her way. And I didn't, I mean, just victim. She, you know, they just kept feeding my victim, and you're right. You're right. Poor me. Poor me. Not one of the many therapists that I had, and I had many, ever said, Claire, what was your reason for going to AA? What are you doing at a meeting? Do you have a sponsor? Have you been working the steps? Are you doing service? Do you have a service commitment? Claire, what are you wearing to a meeting? Nobody asked. Had they asked, I might have been able to identify that my actions had contributed to that situation. I didn't deserve what happened, but I'm not a victim of it either. I am not a victim. I was a willing participant, an unwilling part. You know what I'm talking about. I set it up. I set it up. He teed it off. So I just kept doing therapy. I kept doing therapy. I met my husband not long after that event. We started moving around. We went from LA to San Diego, then up to the Bay Area, where we've been for the last 30 plus years. And every time I came into a new town, I would find out where the fellowship was, just in case. Just, you know, just know where it was, and I would attend for a couple of meetings. And, you know, I always felt better when I was in the rooms, but again, I don't like you now. Now I don't like you because bad things happen to me here. So I visit. When things get really hectic in the outside world, I would come into AA and I would stay for a bit. I'd attend a few meetings. I take. Gee, maybe I need a meeting. So I would go and I would take from you. I would try to take your sobriety. I would try to take your time. I would take your coffee. I would take, and then I would leave. And a lot of times I felt better, but I hadn't contributed anything to the meeting. I'm a taker. That's who I am. I'm a taker. I'm sober and I'm taking. And it was about 1999. I am sitting on my couch at home. I look very much like an active alcoholic. My life has gotten very small. The world is way too big and too scary. You know, you're just not doing it right. You're not following my direction. I work out of my home, so personal hygiene is going down the drain. You know, I don't really need to shower all that frequently, and who's going to know? And I'm just working down the hall, and I'm back to being a menace on the road when I did have to go out to survey property or whatever I was doing. The white noise of alcoholism was so loud, that constant, oh my God, we all know what that's like. It's just always harping and chipping and bitching and just. And the only way I could shut that down was to put my head in a book. But I'm driving. So I turn the radio on, I have a book in my lap, and I drive. And I'm trying to block out alcoholism, the strange mental twist, that unrelenting critical voice that's waiting for me to drink again. It's setting it all up. It's telling me it would be so much easier. It would be so much easier. But, you know, you don't have to have a really good motive to do a right thing. The only thing I had going for me, other than my marriage, was that I had 22 years away from a drink. It was the only thing I had going on. It was the longest period of time I had done anything, and my ego was very invested in that sobriety date. But it's something that happens when you get really invested in a sobriety date, but you're as dry as kindling, is that sober suicide becomes an option. I'm not willing to drink, but I'm willing to die. And I was sitting on my couch surveying my room, and I'm watching the workers finish a remodel of my home. I have a house that sits up on a ridge that overlooks Beautiful view. I have a husband who loves and adores me. I have the car I always wanted to drive in the garage. I have a good paying job, money in the bank, and Don's favorite present to me is jewelry. I mean, I have got it made. I have everything on my Cinderella list that I ever thought would make me happy. And the thought crosses my mind that if I have everything that I ever thought would make me happy and I am in this much pain, I don't want to live anymore. And I had enough prescription medication in the house to kill myself. And that was the plan. And as I'm planning it out and trying to figure out how I'm going to do this, and it'll just be quiet and I'll just go to sleep and Don will just come home and I'll be gone. Again, selfish and self-centered. No idea of what walking in and finding your wife dead on the couch is going to do to somebody. I'm planning it out thinking this is just the easiest, softer way. And this little voice showed up and said, before you do that, why don't you go to a meeting? Oh, okay. I've been going to meetings for about 2 years. I now know that I need a sponsor, but you know what? Nobody will sponsor me. I dropped the sign that said 13-step bait years before, but now what lights up is toxic waste. I have never worked the steps. I have never been sponsored, but I have 20 years of therapy, and I'm more than willing to tell you how to run your life. Nobody wants to be near me. I freely share at meetings, you know, because I go to noon meetings. I have more time than everybody there. You know, so I have to step up to my responsibility. So I go to meetings and I would ask somebody for a sponsor, they would sponsor me and they'd say, nope, I'm so sorry, I have my 3 sponsees. And so now I know that you can only sponsor 3 people. And and I said, well, is there a waiting list? How do I get on the waiting list? And does somebody actually have to die before I get a sponsor? And I'm okay with that, but who's on the verge, you know? And so I've been going to meetings for 2 years and nobody will sponsor me. Nobody will put out their hand to me. So this particular day I go in and I sit at the seat I always sit at, and this, you know, and the meeting goes on and I'm sitting there, and then we circle up. We make those very creative circles. And the secretary moves in right next to me. And she grabs my hand and they say the Lord's Prayer. And mentally, I've already left the room. I'm gone. But she's not letting go of my hand. And I'm trying to get my hand back from her without looking her in the eye, kind of like maybe she's talking to somebody else and forgot to give it back. And she won't let go of my hand. And I finally look at her and she said, you know what, you don't look so good. Are you okay? Oh, somebody finally noticed. And so I went into my wine to tell her everything that was wrong. How nobody would ever, I didn't have anybody to talk to and nobody would sponsor me. And I was this and I was that and wah, 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 wah. And she put her hand up and said, I'm sorry, don't you have a lot of time? I said, well, yes, I have 22 years. And she said, well, isn't it about time you started giving something back to Alcoholics Anonymous instead of sucking it dry like you have been? And if you want a sponsor, what are you doing at noon meetings? You need to get to night meetings. That's where the sponsors are. They have jobs. If you want somebody to talk to, why don't you try showing up 20 minutes before the meeting starts or stay 20 minutes after instead of skating in and out like I watch you do week after week? And why don't you try putting your hand out to somebody else instead of waiting for somebody to come up to you? And why do I always see you sitting there waiting for somebody to pour you a cup of coffee? Why don't you get off your butt and pour a cup of coffee for somebody else? And you know, there are coffee cups at that bar that need to be washed. I suggest you go wash them. And then she got nasty and said, there's a woman's meeting that meets down the road on Tuesday night at 6:45. I'm going to be there. I suggest you show up. Well, I had several things to say to her. But you know, she was in the process of saving my life. Had she said, There's a directory in that back corner that lists all the meetings in the area. I suggest you go get a directory and get to some night meetings. I would never again have come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the woman who knew what her primary purpose for being at a meeting was that day, that woman that knew that what she was to be looking for was the still suffering alcoholic, the still suffering alcoholic that day was not a newcomer. It was somebody who was 22 years away from a drink and dying that day. And she knew that was her purpose for being there. And she was willing to risk my wrath to tell me the truth. And she had less than a year. So you can see why I had several things that I wanted to say to her. But truly, the only thing that came out of my mouth was okay. Because she said she would meet me, and I was desperate for help. And I showed up at that meeting, and those women started changing my life. I sat in that meeting, and it started like I had thought every other meeting started. I'm losing my kids to CPS. I've got to go to court. I've lost my job. I've lost this. I've lost that. And I'm going, God, these losers. But after the meeting, when I'm about ready to dash, this woman came up to me and she said, "Hi, my name's Sue. We stack the chairs and put them in that little room." And I said, "Well, great." But you know, Sue, I have a little disability and I'm not really supposed to lift anything. And she said, "Yeah, cushions forward and just go put them in that little room." And I thought, okay, I guess I am hauling chairs. And then she called me a week or so later and she said, "Claire, there's a newcomer that needs a ride to," she doesn't have a car, "she needs a ride to the meeting. I want you to go pick her up." And I said, "Oh, you know, surely there's somebody with much less time than I have that is qualified to do that type of stuff." And she said, "Yeah. Okay, here's her phone number. Give her a call." I said, "I don't know what to say to her." She said, "Okay, Claire. Hi, my name is Claire. I understand that you need a ride to the meeting on Tuesday night." Yes. "Where do you live?" Get her address. Okay? Once you've got to establish a time that you're going to pick her up, go pick her up. So I said, "Okay, yeah." I said, "But what am I supposed to talk to her about? I don't know." She said, "No, just go pick her up. When she gets in the car, ask her how her day went. She'll take it from there." And Claire, should she ask you how long you've been sober, just get her to the meeting. Tell her anything. They did the absolute act of kindness. I was taught by a mentor when I was coming back that the kindest thing I can do for a newcomer or somebody new to the area is put a broom in their hand. I am better served to put a broom in their hand than I am a big book in their hand. Because I need to give them a reason to come back. And if I have given you a purpose and a direction for being in the meeting, you will come back. And I can take you through the book and I can do that type of thing. But if I can't get you to come back, what good is the book? We all know that you can go to any used bookstore and find our literature all over the place. Give them a purpose. They gave me a purpose to show up because God knows I didn't like you and didn't want to be hanging out with women. And those women kept me entertained long enough for God to show up in my life. I got a sponsor. The woman said, came up and said she would help me because I had lost the ability to ask. I had asked way too many times and been turned down. And that woman had a little over a year, and it didn't matter. She'd already been through the steps once and was going through them again. She was in service. I didn't need somebody at that point in time to match my sobriety. I needed somebody to introduce me to recovery. And she had more recovery than I did. And I started on this journey, and I started doing things. They taught me how to socialize. They taught me how to show up. They taught me the difference between a convenience and a commitment. You know, when they gave me a job, it was not whether if I was in the mood to do it, because they could pretty much guarantee I would never be in the mood to do it. They said, you show up regardless, and if you don't show up, I want a phone call and a note that you were on your deathbed, signed by your doctor. They weren't really nice ladies, but they were active. And I was blessed to have been fallen into an area that was a hotbed of AA enthusiasm. These women were not step-oriented. They were three-legacy-oriented. They were doing the steps, the concepts, and the traditions. They were applying them in their lives, in their meetings, and in their communities. They raised the bar of what it means to be a member of recovery, to be an example and an attraction so that people want to come back. I don't know if you guys have been discussing the feasibility statement questionnaire that came out from General Service, but our fellowship has gone flat, which means as many people as coming out, there are people leaving. We are not holding an attraction and a purpose. For the first time in our history, only 41% of the meetings that are listed with General Service in U.S. Canada are contributing anything to New York to help carry a message of recovery. We are in trouble. I didn't know that when I came in. I didn't even know that there was a New York. I went to my meetings. I went to meetings that were convenient. And these people introduced me to AA as a whole. They broadened my perspective and told me that it just wasn't what I did here, it's what I did out here. The book is very clean. It says the greatest demonstration of our recovery program of recovery is in our homes, our communities, and our jobs. If I was arrested for being a member of AA, would there be enough evidence to convict me? Would you know that I tried to live my life by spiritual principles and actions? Or am I still just not drinking? I don't want to go back to just not drinking, because just not drinking is all about me and this heroic thing that I am doing for a very long time. So they got me into business. They got me busy. They got me very busy. And about that time, that early being back in the rooms days, I got a call from my family, and my brother had gotten arrested by the DEA. It turns out that he's a very good farmer. Who knew? And he's a really good farmer, big crop. And he is going to prison. There's no doubt. He will end up in prison, and I'm devastated. Now, my brother did take a lot of the attention off me, a lot of the focus off me when I was growing up, so that was always good. Look at him as I go over to do what I'm going to do. But I don't want him to go to prison. I love him. I don't want him to go to prison. And I showed up at an AA meeting, and I'm devastated, and I'm crying. And the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous came up to me afterwards and embraced me and started sharing their experience, their strength, and their hope when a family member, a loved one, is going to be sentenced. And it was the crack in the veneer that was needed. I didn't know what to do about this. I don't come from that environment. But you knew, and you shared with me warmly and generously. And then, rather directly, one of my friends got hold of me and she said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go down. You're going to go down for his hearing. And you're going to be there and support him. And when he goes to prison, you're going to write to him every week. And you're going to accept those collect phone calls from the penitentiary. And you are not going to turn your back on him. You are not going to leave him in the cold of shame. You are going to be a stand-up member of Alcoholics Anonymous for him. So I went to his hearing, and he was remanded to us, to my mother and my care, to surrender at a future date. for a prison sentence. And as I'm driving him home, I said, you know, you might want to look into a meeting. You might want to look into attending some meetings to help you, to get some support. And he said, oh, I'm done. Never doing that again. And I said, yeah, I know. But this is kind of like a 30-year habit. And there may come a time in the middle of the night when the weight of what's in front of you, the fear of going to prison, is so huge, you'll think, who'll know? I just want to take the edge off. And if you use and you test dirty, you're going away for 10 years. I would suggest, he said, well, where should I go? And I said, NA. You're a smoker. It's a drug. Go to NA. So he did. And I called him, they called me, or I called him, he called me, whatever happened. And I said, so, how was the meeting? And he said, what a bunch of losers. They shoot things into their arm, they snuff it up their thing, they're taking pills. What a crap. And Tradition 5 landed in my heart. It went from something that is read during the course of a meeting into my heart. He was not identifying. He was not hearing his drug of choice talked about. And it, all of a sudden I understood what my primary purpose has to be and why it's so important I talk of alcohol at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and not something else. It is not because I want to exclude you from my club. Go away, you frighten me. Go to your own club. I can kill you. If you're sitting in this room and you're not an alcoholic, but you have another pressing addiction, and you're not hearing anybody talk about it, the way you used it, the way you went to get it, the lengths you did, the coming off of it, you're not going to be one of us. You're going to be just outside the circle. And if you're not one of us drinkers, how do you do 12-step work? How do you talk to another drinker when you're not one? So the thing that saves my very life is one alcoholic talking to another, I'm going to deny you that right. You don't got to qualify for that because you don't drink. I'm not trying to be mean. I'm trying to save your life. And I'm not going to waste your life. I'm going to risk offending you to hopefully save your life, because that's the example that's been set for me, is that people have been very honest with me, never brutally. If somebody identifies as an addict at a meeting, I am not going to jump up and say, hey, you're not welcome here, this is a closed meeting. Never. Well, I'm going to try to help you find a meeting where you might identify, where you can find the fellowship you crave. My brother wasn't hearing it. His life was on the line. Living in Los Angeles, he was very fortunate. He went to Marijuana Anonymous. He found home. He found people that would talk about recipes. He was happy. And he has 16 years clean at this summer. 15 years, 16 years clean. Because he could identify, he found his people. But I told him, because you told me that he could go to the meetings and prisons were opened and he would be welcomed. I didn't know that from experience. That's what you told me. And so when I was taking those collect calls from him, I would ask him if he'd gone to a meeting. And he said, there aren't any. I said, no, yes, there are. Yes, go talk to somebody, go talk to a guard, go talk, they know, they're there. The next week, same thing, have you gone to a meeting? No, get out of your bed and get to a meeting. They're there. Third week, fourth week, whatever, tell them again, have you found a meeting? He said, I told you there are no meetings. And I said, I put money in the can, there are meetings. He said, there are no meetings. So as required by my friend's direction, I went down to see him. And he was in Lompoc. And there are four facilities in Lompoc. I didn't know that. There's a medium, a maximum, a medium, a boot camp, and a camp. And he was at the camp. And at that point in time, there were not enough members doing H&I work. There were not enough members available to take meetings in, so there were no meetings. And it finally dawned on me that meetings don't happen because we have a format to support one. Service doesn't happen because we have an arm that identifies a need. Service happens when people show up and a message is carried. Books were available. Hands to take the book into the facility were not. There were no meetings. So I left that prison with a commitment to start doing H&I because I wanted there to be meetings for somebody else's family member should they find their way into prison in my area. And prior to that, I had only been taking six-month commitments. You know, just, I'll make coffee, I'll go get books, I'll do that. But because I don't know how long I'm staying, I have much more experience leaving AA than I do staying at AA. So 6 months, I figured I could hang at anything for 6 months. And I said that I wanted to do H&I work, and the coordinator said, wow, Claire, you know that's a year commitment, right? I said, oh my God, really? Well, it's really only 12 times. I could do that. And so I showed up. Because my brother was in prison, I could not go to the prisons. I started at the jail. And I went to the training, and I'm ready to go into my first day of jail, Santa Rita Jail in Alameda County. And I'm sitting out there, and this woman said, I don't remember exactly what Penny said, but she just started changing my world. She identified, she said, when did you get sober? And I said, oh, 77. And she went, oh, you're a classmate. And I thought, no, I don't remember you. And I graduated in 74. She said, no, I got sober in 77. Really? I've never met anybody that gotten sober in 77. And she said, have you been doing this long? I said, it's my first day. I said, but I'm really not certain what I'm doing here. What is this little white girl from the suburbs going to talk to anybody about? And she said, Claire, you are never going to beat them to the bottom. You're never going to have a better story than they have. They're in jail. You're not. So this is not, doing H&I is not about matching their stories. They already know how to drink, and they know how to get arrested. Your job is to identify as an alcoholic, somebody who has had a drinking problem and is no longer being plagued by the suffering of alcoholism. And then you're to tell them what happened to flip the switch, what occurred that started you on a different path, and what you do every day to maintain a freedom from alcoholism. Oh, different game plan. So I did that. I started going into that. And I'd been doing that for about a year when I got a call from the federal camp in Dublin that I had been recommended to start a meeting at the camp. So full circle. There were no meetings at the women's federal camp, like there were no meetings at Lompoc. And I got to start a meeting and take it into the women. And the women were very interested in getting real AA meetings. They were not interested in group therapy. And so we took a book study, a 12 and 12, a big book, a daily reflections, and we had a speaker come in once a month so that they would get a taste of AA as a whole. And that meeting has been going on for 15 years. About 7 years ago, I got a call from a coordinator at San Quentin asking if I would join the team. They were looking for women who had a strong commitment. I mean, think about this, guys. The woman on the couch. The woman who has more time away from a drink than she has recovery. And I'm getting a call asking me to sign up and take a meeting into the San Quentin because I've got a reputation for having a strong commitment to recovery. Amazing. So I got added to the list of San Quentin, and I take a meeting in on Friday afternoon. And I take a meeting into just members like us, only these members committed a crime, and usually a very serious crime, by the time that I get to meet them. And most likely they have killed one or more people in the commission while under the influence, or as a result of abusive drink alcoholic homes. And I go into those meetings and I just carry a message. I facilitate a meeting. That's what I do. I secretary a Friday afternoon meeting in San Quentin. Those men know what recovery is. They go out of their way to support each other and to learn a way. Many of them are never getting out. They've been there 25, 35, 45, 55 years. They're not getting out. But they know that if they practice a program based on spiritual principles and service, that they can live in peace. And they do. And they set a really high example for me. H&I has put me in a position to grow roots in Alcoholics Anonymous. It gave me a purpose and a direction. And I am so grateful. And everybody has a niche. That's the greatest thing you can do on this road of recovery is find your niche. There are guys and gals that are great with working with wet drunks. You know, they just light up and they can bring them in. And there's others that can sponsor a lot of people. Others that do PI work or do GSR work or, But the greatest crime you can commit is not finding your niche and doing it to the best of your ability. Mine just happens to be H&I. Although I have never committed a crime, or the one that I've got caught from, I know what it's like to have society look at you in a disgusted manner or to throw you away because you don't meet societal rules or regulations. And when I go into San Quentin and when I go into the federal camps and the federal prisons, I stand at the door and I greet people and I welcome them. I put out my hand, I look them in the eye, and I say, "Hi, my name is Claire. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I wait for them to tell me their name. They are rarely asked their name. They are always asked their number. But I ask for their name, and I welcome them. And in the meeting, I tell them that I'm waiting for them to get out and that there will be a place that they are welcomed when they get out. That they do not, they've served their time. If you've served your time and you're ready to do differently, come to us. Come to us. Let me know where you're going to be so that we can hook you up. There's a great commitment called Bridging the Gap, which meets guys and women right after they've been released and gets them to a meeting. So that, when the guys are released from San Quentin, they're dropped at the bus stop right outside the prison. You know what's across the parking lot? A bar. They've been given so much money to get on a bus. And if they don't have a plan of action or they don't have a sense of hope and welcome, they often walk right across the bar. And they're back in within 30 days because they didn't have a plan. I want to carry a message of hope and a plan. And I can carry that message of hope and a plan because I've come to you and you have given me a message of hope and a plan. I have a sponsor. I sponsor women. I am anchored in service. And I am so grateful for the nice, big, wonderful life that I've been given. And I thank you for my sobriety, and I thank you for that life.